Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
There are few people we trust more than our doctors with confidential information. So how does it make you feel to know your doctors or the facilities they work for might be selling your medical records to the highest bidder? From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. To be clear, your name is removed from those records before they're exported to companies looking to use them. But intimate details about what you've been diagnosed with, what medicines you've been prescribed, and how long you take them could be collected somewhere in a file and used to change the way drug companies market to your doctor. Even more disturbingly, as my guest will explain, there are no guarantees that the anonymous information about you can't be linked right back up with your name and used against you. Adam Tanner is writer in residence at Harvard University's Institute for Quantitative Social Science. His new book is called Our Bodies, Our Data: How Companies Make Billions Selling Our Medical Records. And he joins us this hour from the studios of KUAC in Fairbanks, Alaska. Adam, welcome to Think.
Hello.
If we could somehow see every notation recorded about us by healthcare providers in, say, the past 20 years, what kind of information is included in those files?
Well, you bring up an interesting point. We, the patients, can't actually see all of our health records going back in time. Now, that would be very useful information for our healthcare providers. If you came in and say, look, I'm feeling this pain or this or that is my situation, they could look back and say, oh, something happened 3 years ago, or I get a clue from this prescription that you're now taking, there could be an issue. That information would be very useful for your own medical care. But that information could also have damaging information if it was to be circulated outside of the realm of your own health care. And that's what we're talking about, the trade of this medical data for commercial purposes that could have to do with intimate sexual health problems, mental health issues, diseases you've had, minor or major ailments you've had. So it's something that you'd want your doctors to know about, you wouldn't want outsiders to know about.
And I don't want to get too far afield here, but it's worth noting that despite everybody's best intentions, we've created with the digitizing of medical information a kind of medical babble, because electronic files at one facility with one doctor don't necessarily correspond or talk well with another hospital or doctor.
That's exactly right. So different electronic medical record systems do not interface well with the other ones. Now, there's been some great progress in recent years in digitizing records. Most doctors' offices, perhaps around 90% today, now have electronic medical records. This has been helped out by more than $30 billion of U.S. government subsidies. But the problem with the U.S. government subsidies is they didn't insist upon speaking a common language. So if you go to one doctor today, but in a year's time you go to a different one because your health plan has changed or you've changed jobs, those systems may not talk to each other. It's like speaking French and German, and so you don't have this uniform record.
So, you know, our neck hurt in 1994. We had a stomach virus in 2003. Maybe something more serious came along later. How is that information valuable to companies?
So this is a multi-billion dollar trade, this commercial for-profit trade in our medical data. And it's valuable to companies because they want to market to the doctors. Drugs are not prescribed without doctors. In other words, there's no sale of medication without someone saying, here is my okay that you can buy this drug. And if the drug companies can influence the doctors to buy their medication versus that of a rival company, then they're all the better for it. And so the more insights that they can have about the doctors and about their patients, the more profitable it can be for the drug companies.
What's interesting is that I wouldn't think doctors would take kindly to the idea that they're being profiled by selling our information. What they're actually doing is giving up a lot of confidential information about how they practice medicine.
The interesting thing that I found in researching my book, Our Bodies, Our Data, is that throughout the evolution of this commercial trade in our data, people along the line have not known. So even today, there are doctors that do not know that information that they enter into electronic medical record systems are sold. There are pharmacists who are giving you the prescription that do not know that copies of the prescriptions from their chain pharmacies are being sold. And pretty much all patients do not know that this is being sold. But the sale is taking place from the electronic medical record systems providers, from the big drugstores, from the big labs where you might have a blood or urine test, and also from your insurance providers. So it's this vast trade, but there are many people, even within healthcare, that do not know about it.
So it's not like your doctor or my pharmacist, it's not like they're somehow getting a cut of this.
Well, if you're a small independent pharmacy, perhaps you could, but it's much more easy and profitable to buy from a large chain such as CVS or Walgreens, and that's where most of the data comes from. There are some doctors who sell directly by participating in plans, but that's a very small amount of doctors who actually send specific information about patients. Typically, it's coming from the middlemen or their interfaces, because the doctors are recording information into a computer system of the electronic health records. They may be sending information to the pharmacy so that you can easily pick up the drug. Those electronic medical record systems and middlemen may be selling the data.
What does it take to match up any individual's, say, pharmacy records with records at a doctor's office or a hospital?
So this is an interesting process. Basically, the way it's done is a big commercial data mining company, the best known of which, or the maybe not known, but the biggest of which is called Quintiles IMS. They give software to the participating companies. So they would give software to CVS and Walgreens and to the electronic health record systems. That software will generate the same patient code wherever you go. So you may pick up a prescription today at CVS, but at Walgreens in a month's time, they'll figure out, oh, this person with this birth date, this name, these other background details, we will generate the same patient code. And then that patient code will be able to join up all this information about you so that the commercial companies over time will have a big dossier about you and your health problems. It won't have your name, but it will have your birth date, your gender, partial zip code, or what part of town you live in, and the specific name of your doctor or doctors.
So how hard would it be to figure out that that patient code refers to you or to me, Adam?
So increasingly, it is possible, as you gather more and more information about any person, to figure out who they are. So I could use myself as an example. I'm talking to you from Fairbanks, Alaska, where I'm teaching at the university for a year. If you knew that I had medical treatment here in my previous location, which was around the Boston area, and my previous location before that, Belgrade, Serbia, I might be the only man of my age or my birth date who would be recognizable. I was thinking about this. There could be some Serbian who somehow studied in Boston who then came to Alaska, but he wouldn't be my exact age. So it would be likely that you could identify me even through this kind of giant haystack. Yeah. I would be the needle, but just knowing that little bit of information, you could pick me out.
What would be the motivation for anybody to go to even that much trouble to figure out that it's you?
So there could be a whole bunch of motivations. Just in the past week's time, we've heard rumors of a possible dossier about our president-elect Donald Trump. Now, information that you could use to blackmail someone or to use against them could be of a sexual nature, it could be of a financial nature, or it could be of a medical nature. And this medical data, if you could find it, could be used not only by foreign governments or adversaries, it could be a workplace adversary that knows you've been out sick for a certain amount of time and they want your job. It could be a romantic rival. It could be a criminal who wants to hack your identity and get free medical care or build credit cards in your name, get information about you to use it against you. So there are certainly things that can happen that would be very detrimental if this information were in circulation.
A lot of us these days, if we need a prescription, go to a big superstore like a Walmart or a Target, where you can also buy other kinds of things. What are the possibilities that, you know, if I go to pick up a prescription at Target and then I'm also shopping for a party and I buy nothing but chips and beer, that somebody might make assumptions about my own care for my health?
So we're now entering into a different realm of data that's available about you that's also for commercial sale. So what we've talked about initially is the sale of your anonymized information from the doctor's office, the hospital, the blood test lab, and so on. Things that are sold commercially about you, that information can be freely sold with your name, address, phone number, email address. And so if you buy food that suggests a certain habit, if you subscribe to a cable television package, which suggests you never leave your living room, if you buy very large pants from a retailer, all of these things can be gathered and there can be inferences about your health made from that. And from those inferences, companies could decide to do business with you or give you certain discounts or not. So it is legal, for example, for a life insurance company to deny coverage based on what they think they know about you, or you could get certain offers. And so this is the darker side of this big commercialization of our patient data and of our non-patient data.
Are insurance companies actually acquiring this information for, I don't know, statistical purposes, if nothing else, even if the data remains anonymized?
So we should mention that for under the current U.S. rules that may be changing soon, the it is illegal to deny anyone health insurance based on previous condition. However, for life insurance, you could deny coverage based on what you know about them. So there is this collecting of information, and it does make business sense in many cases. However, there is this danger of discrimination, and that's what we need to be aware of.
Art, I want to talk a little bit more about this profiling of doctors based on their patterns of prescribing medications for particular patients. Tell me what you learned about how data is collected and how assumptions are made about doctors.
Well, I should mention that finding out anything about this trade in patient data and in doctor data is a difficult task. I've been an investigative reporter. I worked 5 years in Moscow. I had to use the same techniques to sort of put together the story of the evolution of this business in the United States and abroad. For many years, doctors themselves did not know that outside companies were gathering this information, but it can be extremely lucrative. And in the 80s and 90s, it grew dramatically. The outside companies want to know, what is Dr. Jones in Dallas prescribing to their patients? Now, you might work for drug company B, and by following Dr. Jones, you see he's always prescribing the drugs from drug company A. So you might call him up and say, Dr. Jones, let me take you out to dinner. Here's some free samples. Here's other things. Let's spend some time together. All of this is specifically targeted, knowing what Dr. Jones has been prescribing to his or her patients.
Because ordinarily when Dr. Jones accepts a visit from a pharmaceutical salesperson, I would imagine there's some chatter, but the doctor is under no obligation to say, well, yes, I've prescribed your drug 600 times in the last 4 years. That's the kind of thing that they couldn't know for sure until they bought this data.
So in the early years, there were some, like decades ago, the pharmaceutical reps might go to the local drugstore. And if they chatted up the pharmacist there, they would say, oh, how is Dr. Jones doing with my drug or the prescribing? They might let them behind the counter. But that was a very primitive way of finding out information because you might go to multiple drugstores. It would be hard to find out the complete records. This is pretty scientifically and well done. There's another way data could be used that might be surprising to your listeners. You go get a blood test or a urine test that the doctor sends you to do. Imagine that it's a Thursday. You have that test. The results are ready, and it's sold to a commercial company, and it shows that you are positive for a certain disease. So you're going to come back to the doctor's office on Tuesday and learn the results of that test. On Monday, a commercial rep comes in to Dr. Jones because they know it's Dr. Jones that has a patient of this age that's coming in with this problem, and they'll say, Dr. Jones, I understand you have a patient with this problem coming in, let me tell you about our great new medication. Now, it may be that that rep is telling them about a great new medication that the doctor did not know about. It is also possible they're trying to sell an expensive drug when a cheaper generic would do just as good a job.
My guest is Adam Tanner. He's writer in residence at Harvard University's Institute for Quantitative Social Science and author of a book called Our Bodies, Our Data, How Companies Make Billions Selling Our Medical Records. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372, email think@kera.org, or find us on Twitter at @KERAThink.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering courses in art, literature, film, history, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Adam Tanner, who is writer in residence at Harvard University's Institute for Quantitative Social Science and author of Our Bodies, Our Data, How Companies Make Billions Selling Our Medical Records. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. Adam, I want to get to the idea of HIPAA, because I think a lot of people assume that because of these new privacy policies that we've had for a number of years, we will know if our information is being sold. In fact, if I understand correctly, HIPAA explicitly creates loopholes to allow this sort of thing to continue.
So HIPAA says that if your data is anonymized or certain pieces of information about you are removed, then it's no longer your data. So that means if your name is gone, if your address, social security number, things of that nature are gone, then that information can be freely traded without you even knowing about it, let alone having a say in what happens with that data.
Some people might say health problems are nothing to be ashamed of. Who cares if the world knows that somebody has tennis elbow or high blood pressure? Can you explain how somebody could be harmed if such knowledge were not kept private?
Well, it may be that many of us are healthy, go to the doctor once a year and have a clean bill of health, and there's not much to say about our health. We're in fine condition. But many of us know or have relatives or former schoolmates who have suffered from mental health issues, for example. And if that information were in wide circulation, that could lead to job discrimination. It could lead to other kinds of opportunities that would be lost. And that's certainly the case with different kinds of health issues that one would have. So the wide free distribution of this information or wide circulation of it can lead to this kind of discrimination or opportunities or embarrassment that you did not expect to happen from that circulation.
You prominently feature a Texan in this book. Tell us about Deborah Peel and how she became a crusader, really, for medical privacy.
So Deborah Peel is a Freudian psychiatrist who's based in Austin, Texas. And on the very first day that she opened up her practice, someone said to her, "If I pay you cash, is it possible that you will not circulate my records?" And she said, What are you talking about? Of course, the psychiatrist sessions will be private. And then she began to understand that this information does circulate. And she went on to set up a group, which is the foremost patient privacy group today, called Patient Privacy Rights. I think her foremost contribution in the field is understanding that if you don't have complete confidence to share information with your doctor, whether it's your regular general practitioner or a psychiatrist or some specialist treating you for some disease or special problem, then the whole system can be undermined because you would not be fully disclosing everything that's happening to you. There would be incomplete information. Interesting, you could think about, for example, if you went to go see a religious figure to give confession or to tell them about your problems, it would be really interesting if that information would be sold or circulated on an anonymized basis. But to have that information circulated would undermine the trust that you would have in that person. Or the same would be true of an accountant or a criminal lawyer. People who are speaking in confidence with a trusted professional might be less candid if they feared that information would be in circulation. And I think this is the great contribution that Dr. Peel has made in bringing up this issue in recent years.
What can you tell us about the companies that are in the business of buying and selling medical records? How did they realize that there was so much money to be found in aggregating this data and then selling it to people?
So I should say that many of the people who work in this industry are intelligent, fine, upstanding people. They follow what the current regulations and rules are. This is allowed, this trade that we're talking about. However, over time, they realized more and more that there was a commercial opportunity in gathering this more intimate data about patients and about their doctors. The trade really goes back to the 1950s when this company, IMS Health, is formed. It's a parallel company to a big advertising agency for medical products in New York City. And they're initially just studying the market, which drugs are selling well in which countries. But over time, as it's possible to gather more information with the digitization of medical records, then there is more and more data gathering. And in fact, Medicare and Medicaid, introduced in the 1960s, is one of the key episodes that brings a lot of data into circulation that outsiders begin to study. And in fact, For example, in Texas, you have the huge amount of data that was in circulation in the 60s helped bring EDS and Ross Perot to riches and prominence. That kind of information in circulation was the roots of this business.
I heard of lots of people who work as medical transcriptionists, and I guess I didn't really know what that work was for. But in some cases, people are employed to convert paper files into computer files, and those computer files are then usable by these companies.
Well, but it could also be usable for your treatment.
Mm-hmm.
So what we have ultimately is what I call a paradox of patient data. So the information that we as patients would like to have access to our own files to help in our treatment and access by our trusted medical professionals, we don't have that right now. But at the same time, access that we probably would not want, which is by outside commercial companies trading it for their own gain, that does exist, in which there's dossiers about us. In fact, this company that I mentioned, IMS Health, which recently merged into Quintiles IMS, they have more than 500 million patient dossiers, which they have gathered worldwide.
How does the regulation of this sort of thing in the United States compare with what's happening in other industrialized societies? Let's take Europe for an example.
So Europe in general has stronger privacy protections, but even there, there is this commercial trade of patient dossiers. In some countries, such as Japan, where people live the longest in the world and thus may have longer medical histories, there are what they call a gray zone of information. It's not prohibited expressly, but many do not do it. But I went there and researched for 5 weeks in doing this book and found that more and more American-style data gathering practices are taking place with patient data. So it really it starts from here, kind of some of the techniques were innovative and done here and then brought to other countries across the world.
Why is it so hard for us to get at least a copy of the exact same information that a company might have on us?
So the companies that gather the data say, look, it's anonymized. We couldn't figure out who you are. Now, at the same time, if you go and get a new prescription from your pharmacy, they can generate that same patient code and then put the information into there. But I think what I would like to propose, and I think maybe the best plan, is to say to patients, anything about you is your patient data, whether or not it is anonymized. And then you can choose how to use it. If you want to share it with medical science, you could do that. If you don't want to, you want to keep it private, it's up to you. That's an option I think we should have as patients.
Could this kind of big data, these health records, be used to develop new treatments for complaints that weren't really considered pathological before? I feel like the restless leg people get picked on a lot, but it seems like that's an example of a diagnosis of something that people maybe just lived with in the past that the pharmaceutical industry realized there could be money to be made in coming up with some kind of treatment for it.
So the companies that do this, the data miners, say that there will be scientific and medical breakthroughs that come through having so much information about so many patients. And some of the companies we're talking about include some better-known names, such as IBM Watson Health, LexisNexis, which is known for its legal and other databases, GE. Many of these companies have health records on hundreds of millions of people. So far, according to specialists in the field that I've spoken with, there's not been any amazing breakthrough that has solved a disease or come up with a revolutionary new medication. There have been interesting insights, but the traditional testing of two different group of patients, one taking a medication, one not, a double-blind test, that remains the best way to see and come up with new advances in medicine.
Do Quintiles IMS and LexisNexis and other companies that are involved in this, are they sharing this information freely with scientists?
Scientists that they do share it with scientists. And if you look on the webpage of Quintiles IMS, they have a page where they show some of the studies that have used their data. At the same time, however, a number of scientists and researchers I've talked about said it's often hard to get that information and it's often very expensive. Remember, these companies operate on a commercial basis, and there's a difference there between some of the European countries, for example, which freely make patient data available to scientists to advance science, not for commerce.
Hmm. Have there been a lot of cases of people being demonstrably harmed by the kinds of practices that you're talking about today?
So it's often hard to prove the harms. We know of some instances in which people were anonymously named and then were able to be spotted or recognized. So one person, for example, was at AOL. The CEO gave a talk explaining why they were going to have to cut back on some benefits to the workers. And he blamed very expensive premature babies given by two women at the company.
Wow.
Now, it wasn't difficult to figure out who were the two women who had very difficult premature babies. People knew who these were. So they, in essence, this anonymized information about them quickly circulated. And one of the women, Deanna Fay, has written a book about her experience about the shame and humiliation that she felt from it. But often it would be hard to know whether somehow an employer had gathered information about you and didn't hire you or didn't advance you, advance someone else as a result of that. What we have is a situation where data and the ability to use it far outstrips the rules that we now have. Typically, legislation and policymaking is far behind the advance in data. And that's why I'm bringing up this topic. That's why I think it's worthwhile for discussion.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest is Adam Tanner. His new book, Our Bodies, Our Data, How Companies Make Billions Selling Our Medical Records. You can join the conversation by calling in now to 1-800-933-5372. We will come back to the conversation in a couple of minutes. I have to tell you, I blew it. I was supposed to break in the last segment and remind you all that we are in our winter membership campaign. I was so interested in what Adam had to say that I completely blew through that break. So if you would help me make up for lost time in what we call pitching, reminding you and asking you for a contribution of support, that would be a great help. The telephone number to call is 1-888-694-6931. You can also go online to kera.org. Make a contribution today, and you will be in that drawing that happens this evening for a MacBook Pro. Only the people who have already given in this drive just yesterday and today are on that list, so it's a really good day if you'd like a good shot at winning that computer.
And that challenge, computer is going to be drawn for tonight at 8 p.m. So time is of the essence. And all the kind of rules and regulations and all that good stuff is over at kera.org, which is where you can, of course, enter and make your contribution. You can also call 888-694-6931. I have visual proof that there are people down the hall waiting to take your phone call. I know I saw somebody in there just a few minutes ago. I promise you somebody will answer the phone if you call. And you'll do your part to support public radio here in North Texas.
Yes, the folks in the membership department are much more together than I seem to be today. I believe that we started the hour with a goal of $3,000. Does that sound right to you, Stephen?
That sounds right, as I see it right on our TV screen there. We'll give folks an update when we hear from Pledge Central, but we do know that people are making contributions regardless of if we happen to ask them to this particular hour. So big thanks to Kathy Smith of Garland and Sue Franklin of Cedar Hill. They did their part to support public radio in North Texas. We're asking that you join them. And hey, you might just be the winner of a brand new MacBook Pro computer this afternoon.
We have lots of fantastic ways to say thank you. You can pick yours out when you go online to kera.org. And wonder of wonders, that's exactly where you go to make a contribution as well. We have a really cool Feed Your Brain package, Stephen, that I think a lot of people are really interested in right now.
Yeah, this is the, this was new actually the last drive, and it was so successful that we're continuing it over this drive. And that is the Think Lunch Tote, which is a pretty cool blue tote bag that you can take, you know, obviously your lunch to work. If you're one of those people, particularly if you pull out your lunch at work and listen to the Think Show, well, this is for you. But it's not only that. It's the Think Lunch Tote, but it's also the Anything You Wanted to Know 32-ounce water bottle and one set of to-go utensils that also are Think logoed. So if you spend your lunchtime with Think, this is a way that you can, spend a little more time with us while you're eating your lunch and have visual proof for all your friends that you are listening to what we like to consider the smartest show here in North Texas.
Spend your lunchtime with Think. Spend $30 a month as a sustainer with the station, and you will receive this as a thank you. So many people are thinking about how to combat fake news, how to be sure that there are sources of information that you trust, that work really hard to be nonpartisan nonpartisan and absolutely devoted to the truth, not exaggeration. We appreciate the trust that you've placed in us. We want to continue to serve you. It is your dollars that makes it possible. Your gift to KERA today is not just a nice thing to do. It is a step that you can take in support of real, solid information and of the pursuit of truth. And it's an important time for that in this country.
Chris, you mentioned we have a goal this hour of $3,000 raised during the noon hour for the Think Show. We're making some progress. We have just $2,395 left to go. That's $2,395. You can help make sure that that goal is met. And that reason that we mention these goals is that we want to make sure that we continue progress towards reaching the overall goal of the drive, wrapping up business, and getting back to fully scheduled programming, which we will do the second that the last dollar is raised. You can be one of the people that helps the station get to that goal. Be like Gina Wesley of Richardson, who wrote in to say, "I depend on KERA and NPR to keep me well informed across domestic and international issues, as well as providing concentrated information on topics of particular importance." So thank you, Gina, for those kind words and also for making your contribution. You can join her at 888-694-6931 or online at kera.org.
Public radio membership feels good. You can hear 365 days a year where your money is going, and you can know that you're doing it not just for yourself and your family, but also for the entire North Texas community. If you are a podcast listener, your support is important in keeping that product really fresh and making sure that we have the resources to get it up and ready to go for you, frankly, in North Texas or anywhere in the world that you happen to listen. We would love to hear from you now with a gift of support at kera.org or 888-694-6931.
And by the way, Chris, the Think podcast is downloaded more than 200,000 times every month, and not all of those people are in North Texas. Some of those people live all across the world. We hear from them on a regular basis. You are providing this great content not only for your neighbors and friends, but for people you don't even know, will never meet, but you'll know that you are doing your part and, just providing this really excellent resource to people across the globe. 888-694-6931 is one way you can contribute, or feel free to go online to kera.org. It's fast and easy, and you'll know that you are doing your part. Thanks.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering courses in art, literature, film, history, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Harvard University Institute for Quantitative Social Science writer-in-residence Adam Tanner. His new book is called Our Bodies, Our Data: How Companies Make Billions Selling Our Medical Records. You can join us on Twitter at KERA Think, or you can call 1-800-933-5372. Let's go on the phone now to Stephen in Mesquite. Hi, Stephen.
Hello. How are you?
Very well, thanks.
I was shown a letter by a relative about, five, 6 years ago, and it was from a law firm on the far side of the country from California. The letter said, "We're getting a class action lawsuit started against a particular drug company. That drug company sold a pill called," I won't say it, "but we know from our database that you at one time were prescribed that pill."
Hmm.
It had her name, Social Security number, every way you could identify her. And by the way, here's what's really strange. We do not know that she ever really took that particular medication. So not only are they keeping such private information on people, but it was screwed up information. Something like that could affect somebody's ability to get a job, insurance, and the person will not even know that it's in error. You won't know to go out and correct it because you're not told about it.
What do you know about that, Adam?
So Stephen points out an interesting case that your information is in circulation in so many different places that it can often be hard to pinpoint exactly where it came from. So if you think back to that doctor's experience, you're sitting there alone with the doctor, the door is closed, you think nobody else knows about it. If you actually charted where all the places the data goes to, it would be a very complicated chart, sort of multiple octopuses of arms going in different directions to people who need the data for insurance processing, for sending to the pharmacy, as well as people who don't, these commercial providers. So in this case, maybe this information comes from the doctors who they were surveyed. Maybe it comes from the pharmacies. It could come from a whole bunch of different places. And now in this case, if it was a dangerous drug and they needed to alert people who have taken it, it could be for a benefit. But as Stephen points out, if it's information in circulation that people know widely and she's not even taken the drug, it could be something used against her. So it's just he highlights this instance of how your data in circulation may be used against you or may be used in ways you do not expect.
You mentioned earlier, Adam, that you've met some folks who work in this industry and most of them seem to be decent people. Let's assume that that's true, that they don't have any nefarious purposes, that they have recognized a market for something and are exploiting that market and making a profit legally. How susceptible is all this data that they are trying to safeguard and anonymize? How susceptible is it to hacking by people who don't care about privacy?
So unfortunately, medical hacking has been on the upswing rather dramatically in recent years. And in one most dramatic case, Anthem, the Blue Cross Blue Shield company, they lost almost 80 million names, addresses, phone numbers, employment information, other information, but not the medical details. That was hacked out of their system. There is a U.S. government site that you can see where the latest hacks have taken place. And every day or two, there is a new hack. Sometimes it's just a few thousand names. Sometimes it is millions of names. Sometimes obscure local clinics, sometimes very well-known testing companies or insurance companies. If outsiders hack your medical information, they could use it to recreate your identity for fraud purposes. They could try to obtain a tax return refund in your name. They could try to do other things such as get medical care for free in your name. So this is certainly an area of great vulnerability. And also in terms of recognizing the information that's anonymously in circulation about you, if you match different data sets about the same medical procedures, that's more and more clues that might allow for outsiders to identify patients in these commercial dossiers that we've been talking about.
In terms of better protecting patient privacy, is there low-hanging fruit in the form of existing laws that we could amend or strengthen to give people more options, more choices as to whether or not their information is shared?
So we've talked about HIPAA. Those are the U.S. rules that govern the transfer of medical data. Those date back 20 years. And at the time, the sophistication of computers and the cost of storage or storing lots of information was quite different. So now in the era where it's much cheaper to store everything and it's much easier to sort through those through powerful computers, I think we do need to have a conversation about changing the rules. Now, the first one I mentioned briefly before, I think we should redefine what our medical data is to be anything about our medical conditions, whether or not our information is listed by name or not, whether it's anonymized or not. That would give us the ability to contribute data to science if we want to, or specific institutions, because all over the country there are great researchers doing research on our medical information. Many people would want to donate to them, but I don't think it should be in free circulation. So we should have the ability to say, no, I don't want this to be sold commercially. The first step in that direction would be to redefine what medical data is, and it is anything about a patient, whether or not your name is on it.
All right, back to the phones now. Let's speak with Tom in Atlanta. Hi, Tom.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
I went to a conference a few years ago, and there was a story circulating about something similar here. The presenter had mentioned that Target, for example, had collected a lot of data about their shoppers, and so they were essentially sending coupons to their shoppers based on the practices of things that they were purchasing. Well, this young lady started receiving coupons based on a presumed pregnancy, things that she would need for a pregnancy. And it turned out her father received the information, reviewed her mail, saw the information. This is a young girl. She was under 20 years old, living at home still. and realized that his daughter was pregnant, and she was able to confirm it. But it all came about as a result of the information just from the consumer data. If you now combine that with the medical information, this gets incredibly powerful. In other words, some of this is already happening to us right now.
So, Tom, you bring up an interesting story. That story was first broken by the New York Times. It's the Target Knows You're Pregnant story. And they did use all this commercial information to figure out about medical conditions. They realized that if you bought certain things in a certain sequence, you were very likely pregnant. And things have gotten ever more sophisticated. There's something we haven't talked about yet, and that is the mixing of named consumer information with anonymized patient information gathered from inside the doctor's offices, where outside entities will mix these two files, figure out who's who, and then figure out what type of people are most likely to suffer certain diseases or be afflicted with certain ailments. So they may figure out that men age 47 to 63 who have this level of wealth, who live in this part of the country, are most likely to have this problem. They'll destroy that initial merging of data, and then they'll just buy a traditional data broker list of people who meet those specifications. So all of a sudden, you're receiving an advertisement that says, "Are you depressed? We may have the solution for you." Now, it may be that only half of those people are actually suffering from the underlying condition, but that's way more accurate in terms of advertising than just sending that information to everybody on the market. And it can be surprising. Imagine if you're getting that information at work or while you're giving a public presentation or something to that effect. You didn't expect that this information was going to be used in this way. And that's just building on the example that you've cited, the famous Target Knows You're Pregnant story.
If we are really bothered by what you've been talking about, Adam, is there a way to find a healthcare provider who doesn't share information?
So there are electronic records companies that do not sell information. Epic is one of them. There are many companies that do sell it. There are health insurers that do not sell the information. Aetna is one that does not sell it. There are blood test labs that may not sell the information. The ones that do include Quest and LabCorp, which are two of the biggest lab test companies. The problem is it would be very difficult as an individual to try to specify, to choose your doctor based on which electronic medical record system they use, or to choose your insurer based on what they do with the data, because often you don't have the choice. You might be in a health plan dictated by your employer. They have that one insurer, or you might have a limited range of doctors in your plan. So I think the better way to go about this is to have this public discussion of what's best for us as society. We can't have that discussion unless we know the extent of the trade. And so that was the reason that I wrote this book, Our Bodies, Our Data. And I think that setting new rules on a national level will make it much easier rather than putting the burden on individual patients.
Adam Tanner is writer in residence at Harvard University's Institute for Quantitative Social Science. His book, as he mentioned, is Our Bodies, Our Data, How Companies Make Billions Selling Our Medical Records. Adam, thanks for sharing what you've learned. I really appreciate it.
Thanks very much. If people want to learn more, my Twitter is datacurtain, and I have a website, adamtanner.news.
Great. Thank you. Think is produced by Stephen Becker, who has just walked in the door because this is the winter membership campaign, when we are asking you to make a contribution of financial support to keep shows like Think on the air, to keep anything you ever wanted to know on the air, to keep the hardest working news team in North Texas working hard and serving you. You can do this at kera.org or 888-694-6931. Hey, Stephen.
Hey, Chris. You know, there's a every, you know, membership campaign, our membership staff does a really excellent job of coming up with new thank you gifts. You know, we try and think about, or I should say they try and think about, you know, what is the average KERA listener? What are they into? What would they like to do? You know, how can we best thank them? And there's a really neat one this drive, and it's the passport, the KERA passport. And, you know, as the name suggests, you have a passport that allows you to stream the very ever-expanding on-demand library of PBS programs. So this includes everything from the new season of Victoria by Masterpiece to all six seasons of Downton Abbey, you know, Antiques Roadshow, Nature, Nova, all those shows that you go to KERA television to watch. Basically, this allows you access to all of that programming just on demand at your fingertips. There's more than 1,000 hours of on-demand content there. And this is for just $60 or $5 a month on the renewing plan. So think about that. For $5 a month, you could have access to essentially everything that's available there at PBS. So, you know, it's a really great just kind of investment for yourself, for your downtime, to know that you've got that just ready to go. That's for a $60 contribution. You can get more information about that over at KERA.org or, you know, give us a call at 888-694-6931 and somebody would love to tell you all about it.
If you are worried about the climate in this country of people not knowing where to turn for trustworthy information, I know that you've already found KERA to be a source of trustworthy information. The folks who listen to this station do so because, accurate information matters. Don't you feel like the world would be a better place if KERA continued to be available to many, many people? Your gift of support not only funds the journalism and the information that you consume on this station, it also makes it possible for other people to discover public radio, recognize the value of it, and come along right behind you and make their own gift of support. You can think of your contribution today, $5 a month, $50 a month, $5,000 a year, whatever amount, you can think of that as seed money to grow the next loyal public radio listener.
And don't forget, tomorrow, a little programming note on Inauguration Day, live coverage will start here on KERA beginning at 9 a.m. We won't be making these little break-ins to program tomorrow because obviously it's a really big day and we want to be able to stick with live coverage all day. So it begins tomorrow at 9 a.m. We've heard from a number of folks who have taken just a few minutes to make their contribution. I really like this note from Roger in Birmingham, Alabama, who says, I'm moving away from Texas after 5 years. There was hardly a day that went by without turning on the radio and listening to KERA. Thanks for all the information and entertainment during my time here. Well, thank you, Roger. And just as an FYI, you know, you can still stream us the website, Blast KERA, wherever you are. And your contributions go to pay not only for the over-the-air signal, but for things like KERA.org, KERANews.org, where you can stream the live programming that's happening just as anybody listening to it in their car is listening to it.
This is really amazing. We started the hour with a goal of $3,000 in contributions for this hour of Think Today. We have 340 left to go. We've done almost 90%, that means. And so you can make a contribution, maybe $30 a month, and you can swoop in and be the final person. You can make a contribution of $10 a month, and you and a couple of other people would fill that out. Even if we get to that goal, you will know that your money is being carefully used and perhaps just ending the fundraising campaign a little sooner. One of the luxuries of being in a nonprofit organization is that we only have to raise enough money to cover our expenses, and that is what we do. Then we get right back to the programming, and we appreciate the fact that you are supportive of the station.
And Chris, breaking news, we have made the goal this hour.
Sensational.
So thank you so much to all of you who contributed. Thank you all for covering up for Chris and I forgetting to make the break during the first segment today and really coming through when we asked. We really appreciate it. The station appreciates it. And you should really feel good knowing that you are doing your part in bringing KERA and public radio to North Texas. Please, if you haven't contributed yet, we'd love to hear from you. You'll be entered in automatically to win that new MacBook Pro. 888-694-6931 or online at kera.org. And thanks.